So coming back to dark matter, what I know is that it is stable, and this is also true for protons. And what I know is that protons and baryons have basically a comparable density in the universe. So there is no fundamental reason for this thing here, and even neither for the stability of these two types of matter. So the question is there a fundamental reason for this? And what I'm going to do is to propose a logic underlying these two principles. And the logic is the following. I propose that there exists a new fundamental force of nature, which is essentially the baryon number, which is interpreted as a gauge symmetry here. And this symmetry principle of nature forbids proton decay, as we will see. I will give you conditions, sufficient conditions for this to happen. And if you try to construct models in which this is true, okay, I mean, when I say that the proton is stable, I mean that this is true beyond the renormalizable level and in any theory that has this property. One can arrange in a model-independent way a few conditions for the proton to be exactly stable at the perturbative level. And in any such theory, you will have new stable particles. And of course,
recorded as a theorem because of anomalies, or?
Yeah, essentially, yeah, precisely. I will argue this. I mean, yes, it's a very simple thing. It has to do with anomalies. You need more fields that carry their own anomalous quantum number. The outline of the talk is the following. I will start by asking this question, why is the proton stable? And then I will propose the baryon number as a gauge symmetry, and then discuss how dark matter arises in these models. And then I will briefly discuss a very simple model, although this is not minimal, but I think it helps to illustrate a few interesting features. And I will assume that the gauge symmetry into which the baryon number has been embedded is just a U1 for simplicity. And so this example will tell us a couple of very general properties of these theories. The first property is that the dark matter will be charged under the new gauge force. So this is, of course, interesting for what concerns experimental signals. And then what happens essentially is that the visible and dark matter have a common origin. They are generated by the very same mechanism that could be, for example, biogenesis here. And so for this reason they will have a comparable asymmetry. And if they can, if I can explain why the dark matter has a mass comparable to the proton or not far from the GV scale, I will also explain why the dark matter has the relic abundance that we know. Then I will discuss what happens. I will explain what happens when we have a species with an asymmetry in general, in particular for dark matter. Then I will discuss the experimental constraints on this force, of course. So let me start with this question, why is the proton stable? So in the standard model, it is stable because there is an anomalous symmetry, which is a property of the renormalizable formulation of the theory. So this means that if we go to higher dimensional operators, if we look for a short distance structure of the standard model, we will find operators like these ones, and that, of course, violate the mediate proton decay. So this means that a generic UV completion of the standard model is expected to mediate proton decay. But at the same time, we know that we believe the standard model is incomplete. So there has to be something out there, and this something has to satisfy some very general principle, perhaps, to forbid proton decay. So what I will use here is a model-independent solution, which is a dynamical principle based on the gauging of the baryon number. And the reason is that, okay, so let me explain why I say local versus global symmetries, because I don't like to impose global symmetries, since these are not really principles of nature. They are violated by gravity effects. So I would like to have some local symmetry that protects the proton. So this might be true if I gauge if I embed the baryon number into a gauge symmetry. This is very simple. I mean, any operator that mediates proton decay has to be an interpolating field here for the proton, and some light fields here that the proton can decay into. These fields, of course, contain, I don't know, the leptons and all the fields we know. There could be also other light fields like the dark matter. there could be, and there has to be in general, some order parameter for the breaking of the of this gauge symmetry, since I don't want to have long-range forces for the baryons. So it is a very simple condition on the gauge charges of these fields that can avoid the occurrence of these operators. And I mean, this is what also works for global symmetries, but here I'm not imposing global symmetries. So I can avoid the occurrence of those operators. And so when I have a local symmetry, of course, I want to have an anomaly-free global symmetry to start with. And therefore, the baryon number has to be, I mean, I need some more fields in addition to the baryons, of course. This can happen, for example, in the standard model. These are the leptons. And I can construct an anomaly-free here, which is B minus L. The point is that B minus L doesn't do the job that I was referring to before, because, for example, B minus L is consistent with these operators. So B minus L cannot be my symmetry of nature that protects proton decay. So what we learned from leptons is that in order to cancel the anomaly of the baryon number, I need new fields. And these new fields will carry their own anomalous symmetry, like, for example, the leptons. So if I do this and I don't want to use B minus L, B minus L is the only non-anomalous global symmetry of the standard model. If I want to have a non-anomalous global symmetry that forbids proton decay, I need to have new standard beyond the standard model fields. And these will be stable for the same reason why the leptons are stable, because they also carry this anomalous symmetry. And these, of course, these new particles will be my dark matter candidates, and very generally. So I have done the first step. So this is a very simple example. This is not minimal, not minimal at all. I'm using supersymmetry just to, because it's convenient for several respects. And so it's not minimal, and it's not an exhaustive list of the possible models. But it's interesting in its own right. So let me discuss this very simple model. So in order to, as I was saying before, in order to cancel the anomalies of the U1 baryon number, I need to include new fields. And these are listed here. I have basically a new generation of quarks and leptons that they have the same charges as the standard model, but they have a different charge under the new gauge force. Particular, okay, if it is just one generation, this is minus one for the quark primes. And for this reason, these quarks will not be like an ordinary fourth generation. In particular, they cannot mix with the standard model quarks. So for this reason, they will be stable. And this is the underlying reason why I have a gauge symmetry here. So these are stable. So I need something for these particles to decay into. This will be the dark matter. The situation is different for the lepton primes. I need those to cancel the anomalies. I'm just copying the standard model to make things as simple as possible. So what they will do, these guys will mix with the standard model leptons, and so they will decay into the standard model leptons. And in a supersymmetry framework, L is broken by renormalizable interactions, and so does R parity. So I can have Majorana neutrinos, and there is no LSP. But we have another dark matter candidate. These two fields are added to break spontaneously the new gauge symmetry. And the dark matter is, in this simple model, a couple of fields, chiral superfields charged under the baryon number with this charge. They will mediate relations of this type. So these quarks will decay into the dark matter and ordinary quarks, and also leptons. Here there is a typo. These guys will decay into ordinary leptons. And the dark matter will also carry automatically the quantum number of these new fields, of the Q prime fields. And so I will call the dark matter symmetry as U1 Q prime for obvious reasons. And one can go through the analysis of the types of operators that could mediate, in principle, proton decay. And one can verify that with these charge assignments, the condition for not having proton decay at any order in perturbation theory beyond the renormalizable level is simply to assume that BS, the charge of BS, which is not fixed by anomaly cancellations, has to be an integer and bigger than one. So it is a very general statement.
So would you say that anomaly free is it in the SUSY sense or is it in just Because as soon as you have additional fermions for the SNP.
Yeah, sure. It's anomaly free. I mean, this is, you see, this is just a fourth generation, so you're not introducing anomalies essentially, and in the standard model subsector, right? And these are these choices here are such that you cancel also the anomaly, of course, of that gauge symmetry. So what we learn from this model, if you write down the most general Lagrangian and so on. What you learn is a few very general features of these models. First of all, if you focus on perturbative realizations like the one that I was just discussing, the dark matter will have a mass set by the weak scale. Otherwise, the model simply doesn't work because, as I was saying, these Q prime fields that cancel the anomalies, they have to decay into the dark matter. So the dark matter has to be below lighter than a state which is a chiral state under the electroweak symmetry, so it will also be, the dark matter will also have a weak scale mass or below. And essentially, if you look in details to see what happens when you gauge the baryon number, you see that essentially the baryon number will effectively force the baryon number of the ordinary quarks and the baryon number of the new quarks, the fourth family quarks, or the dark matter to be essentially an accidental anomalous symmetry. But this, the interesting point is that this is not a property of the specific field content that I'm discussing. This is, for example, what happens in the standard model. This is really a generic properties of these models. This new symmetry tends to force the occurrence of new accidental global symmetry. And a very cool property is that the dark matter will be charged under the baryonic force. And this will have important consequences in experiments. And another cool property that I will discuss now is that if L, if the lepton number is not a good symmetry of nature, for example, I have my random masses for the neutrinos in my MSSM model, if you look for, if there is any accidental non-anomalous symmetry at all in this model, it will only be of this form. It will be a symmetry D constructed with an anomalous symmetry of the baryons, of the ordinary baryons, plus some combination of the anomalous symmetries of the dark sector. So it will be, in general, of this form. So if you want to make baryogenesis work, what you want is to have a primordial symmetry in D, for example, and you can see that this is in complete analogy with what happens in the standard model with B minus L. What you will find is that you will also have an asymmetry in the dark sector. So in words, baryogenesis requires also the dark sector to be asymmetric. So so what I will do next is to discuss what happens when a sector is asymmetric, what happens to the relic abundance, for example, of the dark matter. Are there any questions so far?
So which one of those fields you showed you're actually going to make dark matter, the neutrino, the right neutrino?
No, that will be, it's another particle, it's X. Because these will be stable essentially, and the neutrino here will be unstable. It will decay into standard model neutrinos. Or okay, so this was my example. So let me talk about asymmetries, symmetric Wimp dark matter. What happens when I have a primordial asymmetry? So as I was arguing, baryogenesis occurs via the generation of a primordial symmetry of D, which is a combination of a visible baryon number and dark number. And these asymmetry, the primordial asymmetry here will be shared by these two symmetries, of course. And in the end, what I will find is something of this form. My primordial symmetry in the dark sector will be comparable to the primordial symmetry in the visible sector, which is my 10 to minus 10.
For that to be true, you mean basically the dark matter abundance is not going to be determined by a freeze out event. It's going to be.
I'm going to discuss this now. Yeah.
Okay.
So in this sense, you see, because of the very definition of D, visible dark matter will be generated by the very same mechanism that, for example, in my previous model could be a flectine. If I have flat directions, of course, we identify the few flat direction charge under D. So Affleck 9 goes through as usual. But the only new feature here is that the dark matter also will be asymmetric. So yeah. So let me remind you what happens when you study the symmetric case. And I will try to answer this question, what happens to the radical abundance when I have an asymmetry. So for the symmetric case, so this is the standard equation, Boltzmann equation. Y is my number density of these are Y for particles, for example, normalized to the entropy density. These are the antiparticle density. And X is, as usual, the mass over the temperature. So this is my Boltzmann equation. When I have a symmetric population, to start with, this is my initial condition for some X initial, the two populations are equal. Then what happens is that since also their equation is symmetric, then they will always be equal at any X at any time. And so in this case, what happens, the standard thing is that what happens after result is that we depart from equilibrium. So OK, at high temperature, we are in equilibrium. So these two terms are comparable. But after Friesau, this term will drop exponentially. I'm assuming that my particle is non-relativistic. So what you will find is the usual equation. So there is a derivative will essentially be equal to y squared, because now I have this condition. And what I find is that, of course, as I was saying before, the population is the same. And it is inversely proportional to the cross-section. Fine there. So what happens if I have an asymmetry? Well, that's very different. So suppose that I have a primordial asymmetry eta, which is defined in this way. And this is different from 0. So what will happen is that if you go through the same analysis, you realize that, again, at some point, these particles freeze out. And so this term can drop. But now what will happen is that let's focus on the less abundant species. Let me call it antiparticle. What will happen is that if it's less abundant, it will be easier for these species to find particles to annihilate with. But the opposite is not true for the particles. So what will happen is that the antiparticles will be depleted much faster and much easier. So if I start with an asymmetry here, I cannot even tell here what happened. Here the populations look very similar. My initial condition is something like eta is 10 to minus 10 in this example. What happens is that the more abundant population follows these after it resolves, becomes quickly constant, while the less abundant population depletes essentially exponentially as a function of the cross section. And
so you're actually having an earlier freeze out, right? Because
not really, no.
Once the asymmetry gets large, you.
Well, sorry, I mean, once the asymmetry gets what?
Once the asymmetry gets large, why you just cannot deny it anymore? Or put it differently, you need a larger annihilation cross section, is that right?
You always need a larger cross section, that's right. I will show this in the next slide. So here the parameter space that give you the right abundance is very different compared to the case of asymmetric species. So this plot shows precisely that. This is the mass of the dark matter. And this is the cross section as defined before. I'm extracting the dependence on the temperature, on the velocity cross section. This in particular is for S wave scattering annihilation. And so I am defining this parameter epsilon as the asymmetry of the dark sector and the visible compared to the visible sector. So all these lines for a fixed epsilon correspond to the right relic abundance of the dark matter. And so what you see is that if the asymmetry is zero in the dark sector, this is the usual WIMP case.
Wait, sorry, shouldn't you only show one line for a complex epsilon equal to the ratio of
Well, this is more general to show. Yeah, what do you mean? Like epsilon equals close to one. In my model, this ratio is close to one, so I'm up here. But this is, I'm just telling you what happens more generally. And this is also to show that for epsilon equal to zero, this is the WIMP case. And you find that essentially, in order to have the right abundance, you have a plateau here, which means that irrespective of what the mass is, it is the cross section that has to be fixed. This is what we saw before. In this case, the relic abundance is set by 1 over the cross section. So this is just a matter of tuning the cross section. Okay, let me tell you what happens here. This is basically the QCD phase transition. So here you need for a given mass, you need for a mass below, say, 20 or something GV, you will need a larger cross section because the degrees of freedom decrease. So this is the standard WIMP case. But as soon as you have a non-zero asymmetry to start with, let's focus on this curve, what you find is that if the cross section is very, very large, you see, in order to get the right abundance, you asymptote this line here, a vertical line here, which sets essentially a condition on the mass. This is to say that, of course, if the population is completely asymmetric, it is the relic abundance is dominated, as it is for variance, it is essentially given just by the mass. So in the case in which the population is completely asymmetric, you have to tune the mass. So following this line, of course, here I start with basically no antiparticles. And then as I approach this curve, epsilon equal to 0, I will acquire more and more antiparticles. And when I'm here, these two lines overlap. So the population is essentially symmetric. And so this is this illustrates a very simple thing, which is that if you start with a population which is asymmetric, that has a primordial asymmetry, whether or not today we have an antiparticle population which is comparable to the particle population only depends really on the cross section. So if the cross section is very large, here I'm up here, I don't have any antiparticles. But if the cross section is not too large, I will have a large population of particles as well as antiparticles. So this is an important point to make, which is that a primordial asymmetry does not mean necessarily absence of antiparticles. So this plot here, this curve here, tells you the fraction of antiparticles over particles for a given cross section, as measured in units of dark matter candidate that has the same mass, and this is it is symmetric. This is the usual WIMP case. So, for example, if you see, you see that the cross section always has to be bigger than the case of a symmetric population. If this ratio is close to 1, so the cross section is close to the case of a symmetric population, the ratio is essentially 1. So we have as many antiparticles as particles. But of course, as soon as I depart from the ratio being 1, the antiparticle population is depleted exponentially. It's a very strong effect.
So can I ask you, I know always starting below the phase transition, below the electroweak phase transition.
Okay.
Is that what you're doing? Because above that temperature, you might affect the spiral effects?
Of course, yeah. So I'm assuming that I start from the basic assumption here is that I have a primordial asymmetry which is fixed. You see that in the Boltzmann equation, basically eta is constant. So this is the basic assumption here.
Okay, and that's the symmetry after the spiral result.
Yeah, if the spirals violate your symmetry, of course, yeah.
But he has an aggregate symmetry, so it's not spiral after the
This in my model, I have this symmetry D, which is non-anomalous, and it is only violated by, say, some gravity effects. This is my Aflaxine mechanism. So at some scale, very high scale, this asymmetry freezes in. So this is much higher than the.
There's the jump between the variance and zero. You have the BQ and the prime.
Yes, that's right.
And that's essentially the ratio.
Yeah, that has to be below the Lecamus phase transition. But my mass here, the dark matter mass here, will always have, the dark matter will always have masses of the order of the GV scale. So that's a reasonable assumption.
Wait, so just to clarify that point, with your choice of masses, which is GV, is your freeze-out happening?
The freeze-out temperature here is very, very similar to the freeze-out in the case of a symmetric population. So it's always, X is over the.
So you 15, basically 20. Tune the cross section up to make sure that the freeze-out happens at that temperature? Because
For cross section,
if the symmetry is very large,
the asymmetry.
If the is very large, the symmetry frees up what happened very early.
Yeah, the freeze up. I mean, if the asymmetry is very, very large, well, of course, yeah, will affect. It will affect. I'm assuming that the asymmetry is of the order of 10 to minus 10, and around that, I mean, let's say a few orders of magnitude around that. That is sufficient. I mean, in order to have the freeze out that occurs much earlier, or I mean, at a very different scale compared to the symmetric population, you have to be very, very away from the usual WIMP scenario. This, for example, happens, of course, for baryons, where the cross-section is huge. But if the cross-section is, for example, a few times larger here, if I'm within this range, my argument works. If it is a few times larger, and the asymmetry is comparable, or let's say three or five orders of magnitude different, this is right. It's a good approximation. This figure also shows what happens to indirect signals. And it is this line. This line shows the suppression of the indirect signals of the dark matter population in this case. Of course, the indirect signal goes to zero as the cross-section increases, which is as this ratio decreases. But of course, the reason why the indirect signal is less suppressed compared to this ratio is that, of course, also not only the antiparticle population is less abundant, but at the same time, we have a larger cross-section. So this is compensated. And the indirect signal is less suppressed. So let me go to the experimental constraints on these models. I would like to study the experimental constraints in a more modern, I mean, as in the more general way. So I would like to be as model independent as possible. So if I look at these models, what you see is that typically you will have in the low energy description, the standard model Lagrangian where the baryon number is a gauge symmetry. I'm normalizing this charge such that the charge of the baryons is 1/3 as usual. This is just a normalization. And then in this effective field theory, I will have the dark baryonic gauge boson that I call ZB. Its mass is MB and its coupling is GB. Then I will have a weak scale dark matter field that here, for simplicity, I will assume it is a Dirac fermion. And in general, this Dirac fermion will have either, I mean, it will be coupled either with an axial or a vector current, depending on the specific model that you are considering. We presented a few models in which this coupling can be purely vectorial or purely axial. Then, of course, in general, we have kinetic mixing, because I have an additional U1. But I will focus on models. In order to suppress this mixing, I would like this mixing to be loop suppressed. So the condition that I have to require on my UV completion is this condition. Again, the models that I am that we propose in our paper satisfy this condition. This means that at one loop there is no mixing between B and Y. So only once these Q prime fields, the heavy fields, decouple, I will have a mixing between the hypercharge and the mu gauge field. So the typical signatures of these models are, of course, missing energy. I will have missing energy at colliders. And these are just the strongest bounds that I have. We considered several other bounds, but these are the strongest we have. And we have bounds from Babar, for example, from the invisible width of the upsilon decay. This is a pretty strong bound for light dark matter. If the dark matter is below threshold, then there will be, of course, LHC and Tevatron missing energy signals, jet plus missing energy. And these are the strongest bounds that we found, the ones that have missing energy in it. Of course, there are other bounds because this baryonic force will correct basically all hadronic processes. But if I don't have the dark matter involved, this will be overwhelmed by QCD, essentially. So I have other bounds from Babar, like the invisible width of the hadronic width of the upsilon or the hadronic width of the Z, but this will be less constraining. And then I will also have direct detection signals that we'll discuss. Let me start with big factories and LEP. This is the parameter space. This is the mass of the gauge boson. This is the coupling of the gauge boson. So this is this curve here. Above this curve here, the model is excluded by the corrections to the hadronic width of the Z. this is mediated by a one loop correction, so it's very suppressed. I don't have to do directly with leptons here, so of course the bounds are very weak compared to ordinary Z prime models. So you see here I'm focusing on masses that are below 120, just to emphasize that these bounds are very, very weak compared to the bounds from ordinary Z prime coupled to leptons. Then I have this bound from upsilon, the invisible width of the upsilon here. This is, of course, true only if the Dagmar is below 5 GV or so. And this is a bound that also exists if the Dagmar mass is heavier than 5 GV. And this is, of course, the correction to the hadronic width of the upsilon. These are very, very well measured, so they provide very strong bounds on the low energy region. Then I will have the other bounds that I was discussing before, the monojets at the Tevatron and the LHC. Surprisingly, what we find is that the LHC has already strongest bounds compared to the Tevatron in this search. So what we do is PP or PP bar going to jet plus missing energy. This is the standard model background. Of course, it is the decay of the Z. Of course, you can also miss the charged lepton in the decay of the W. These are the dominant backgrounds in the standard model. And signal is, of course, dominated by QQ bar, where these are valence quarks at the Tevatron, and where the jet is a gluon here instead. At the LHC, the PDF of the gluon will be dominant.
Could you draw the diagram for the signal?
Yes. So I have like something like this. So this is quark, QQ bar, something like this. This is my gluon. This is the Z prime. This is the dark matter. And
How heavy is your Z prime?
Yeah, it's below 120. And well, I'm discussing the case in which it is on shell or off shell in a second. This is the Tevatron, and the LHC will have this inverted, something like that. So of course, the bounds will depend strongly on what happens to the Z prime, and what the relation between the dark matter mass and the Z prime mass is. If this guy can be produced on shell, the bounds are extremely strong. If not, the bounds are very weak. And this is precisely what we see. But before going there, let me emphasize that in these searches, as I was saying, the LHC is doing better than the Tevatron. The data we have are basically the same, the amount of integrated luminosity. And the reason why the LHC is doing better is that they considered higher PT cuts on the jet. This is really the secret here. Interestingly, the bounds are already dominated by systematics. This is due to the fact that QCD backgrounds are extremely strong. So it's not really an improvement in the luminosity here that will help us getting better bounds, but it is an improvement on the PT. Because the uncertainty is dominated by the systematics, one finds that there is really a preferred PT to put the cap. Your chi-squared peaks at some non-trivial PT. So the point is that CDF put this cap at far from this peak, while the LHC, of course, put the cap precisely on that peak. Their bounds are much stronger, as we will see now. So these are the bounds. Again, in this case, I'm focusing on masses for the MB, which are below 30 GV, just to emphasize, because I'm focusing on three very light dark matter masses, 10, 5, and 1 GV. This is again the bound on GV. So let's focus, for example, on 10 GV. What happens here is that, of course, when the mediator Z prime is heavier than twice the mass of the dark matter, as I was saying before, this Z prime can be produced on shell. This process is essentially two-body final state process. The bounds are very strong on the coupling, and you see. And not only strong, but also independent of the mass. They also asymptote to the same, essentially because it doesn't really matter what happens here if the branch ratio is the same. Here, what I'm assuming that is that the dark matter has a charge which is purely vectorial to the Z prime, but of course, very similar bounds arise if we have also the axial coupling. The colliders do not feel any difference So in this region, essentially, it is a two-body process, and the cross-section goes like GB squared. When the mass of the mediator goes below this threshold, which is 2 times the mass of the dark matter, the process cannot be on shell. And essentially, this mediator is massless compared to the strong energies injected into this, these processes by the collider. So the mass becomes now independent, again, on the mass of the mediator. But it is weaker, of course. It is much weaker because now the process is purely three-body in the final state. So this is an on-shell production. That is an off-shell production. And the cross-section here goes like GB to the 4. So when we wrote this paper, we only had the results from the Tevatron. And these are the lines from the Tevatron. The LHC now is improving considerably on the parameter space, killing the parameter space. So this line essentially goes down here now. And the shape is the same. It goes up here. And then here it goes down again, and it decreases farther here. So essentially, in this model for 10 GeV mass, we have this region, which is still allowed by colliders. And you, as you can see, the coupling can be weakly, rather strong, namely a weak coupling, but still very strong. And this is consistent with experiment. This is very, very cool.
There's something I'm not quite sure understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you have bounds on this sort of light Z primes? You can just go on and digest consequences?
Yeah, this is a good point. No.
Why not?
No. This is a good question. There is no bound. So this, I mean,
well, maybe not below 100, but
yeah, not below 100 precisely. So if you look at this figure here, here we go a little bit above 100.
Yeah, this is the figure I started to disagree with.
Yeah. So the bounds. So the only bounds for masses around 100 GeV from DJet production comes from UA2, simply because the Tevatron didn't go below 100. And the bounds are weaker here. They are up here.
Oh, you're saying you're not presenting them because the dronic Z is stronger.
Yeah, it's dominant, yes, for these models. Of course, when the mass is lighter, UA2 doesn't tell us much. The bounds become actually are expected to become weaker. But there is no experiment that tells us what happens below 100 GeV or so, 130 or something. And this is, I think, a crucial thing here. That would be the very striking signal of this physics. But we have no bounds. The LHC will focus on masses above 500 GeV or so. And this is a good, I mean, this is a good question that I would like to ask to experimentalists. Coming to direct detection, so I remind you that this is, in general, the form of the interaction between the dark matter and the gauge boson. So you see, if you have purely vectorial coupling, or the vectorial coupling is somehow comparable to the axial coupling, what will happen is that for direct detection, the scattering will be dominated by the vector coupling. This will be a spin-independent scattering, elastic scattering of nuclei. This is the scattering of nucleons. So in this case, if one assumes that the baryonic gauge force is dominating the annihilation cross-section for the dark matter, then this is a strong constraint. And what you find is that essentially there is no parameter space allowed for a vector coupling, unless, of course, well, there are a few caveats. For example, if the dark matter gets below current threshold of direct detection experiments, which is around 1 to 2 GeV, of course, these bounds do not apply. So in this case, I can evade these bounds for purely vectorial couplings. And of course, one can have new annihilation channels. This can happen, for example. I didn't say anything about strongly coupled theories, realization of these models, but of course you can have them. And in this case, the annihilation will be not, in general, dominated by the Z prime. So in that case, these bounds can be evaded. Then of course, the annihilation can occur on resonance, but this is really fine-tuned, so I will not consider this possibility. The point here is that if these two couplings are comparable, or maybe if this is not too small, then what happens is that this model is only allowed below 1 to 2 GeV, where current direct detection experiments are not telling us anything. When QV is actually equal to 0, this can be arranged in several models. It is actually rather interesting, because in this model, the dark matter is chiral under the Z prime, under the ZB, under the U1B force. So in that case, we can relate the mass of the dark matter to the mass of the ZB in an elegant way. Well, if QV is equal to 0, you find only axial couplings. And in this case, the scattering of nuclei will be velocity and momentum suppressed. And we find that for the masses we consider, the bounds are not constraining so far. So this is essentially the parameter space that I showed before is allowed by direct detection experiments.
So if you annihilate on resonance in this case, does that give you very strong signals or not just because of the velocity?
Well, of course you have to. No, I mean, I'm saying, of course you have to be careful then here, right, in these bounds. But yeah, I'm not considering that possibility
in
because
the annihilation, now you're tuning times the dark matter mass is the C prime mass.
Yes, right? Yes. So in this case, I mean, the annihilation will be enhanced, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, it is fine too. So in that case, the annihilation will be enhanced and the coupling should be smaller in general compared to the case in which MB is arbitrary. And in that case, also the direct detection signal will be suppressed because
the indirect. Oh,
sorry, the indirect. Yeah, that's right. Also, the indirect. Yeah, precisely. Yeah, that's an interesting point. Yeah, we didn't focus on this possibility because we believe it is not generic, so we didn't care about that. So, coming back to our explicit model that I presented before, this is a toy model, and combining all the bounds that we have, in this model, for example, if the dark matter mass was completely vectorial, this is essentially what the parameter space that the LHC leaves, this area here. And so this is the bound from the upsilon decay. This is the bound from monojet searches from the LHC. And this is the line that tells you what the right coupling is to get the right annihilation cross section given the mass of the dark matter of the mediator. And this is for a 1 GeV dark matter. And you can see, of course, I mean, as I was saying before, since here we have a primordial asymmetry, the cross section can be larger or at most equal to the case of a symmetric population. This is the line for a symmetric population. So really, the cross section could be larger. It has to be above this curve here. And therefore, in this case, only this white area is allowed.
It's a little disturbing. I mean, if you have signature so light, this diagram doesn't describe the process of target, right? Because like, you can have very large radiation of the Z prime. The process in the LHC will not be sufficiently described by this simple diagram.
Which effect are you referring to?
Just radial of the Z prime, radial of you produce the X and X bar and they radial of the Z prime. I mean, those things are all massless in the LHC, and so you know it's not going to be just a simple jet plus X and X bar.
You are referring to multi-jet.
So forget about what happens on the star model side. Even just what happens on the dark side is not described by your diagram.
So you mean if I have Q and Q prime colliding?
Yeah,
you have final radiation of crazy, right? Because now everything is very light.
Yeah, we didn't think about that. Maybe you can tell me more about this and I can.
Yeah. Will the bounds get worse or?
No, I mean, not necessarily worse, right? Because like, one thing that could happen is that you can radiate off a Z prime, and
it might open.
Well, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't have an answer now. So.
By the way, this is completely invisible epsilon, okay, right? looked at upsilon decay to gamma plus something, for example. I don't know if that's stronger or weaker.
Yeah, no, it's weaker. It's weaker. Okay. Yeah, it's here. The bound is up here. Now I forgot the number, but yeah, these are the strongest bounds. Yeah, this is for the case of the axial coupling. Again, the LHC kills basically this region here above this red curve. So this area and this area are allowed in this model. And as we can see, okay, just as a reference, this coupling here, which is, let's say, 0.55 for the case of, let's say this bound here, 0.3, the bound from the LHC for the case of 10 GeV dark matter, goes up to 0.5 in the case in which the dark matter has a mass of 30 GeV or so. So it's very model dependent. Before closing, just a digression related to what we were saying before, the fact that the Dirac resonance masses are not bound below 100 GeV is very important in my opinion. So why don't we go below 100 GeV? So the bounds that we have are now from UA2. So what the LHC is doing when they tune their Monte Carlo is to assume that there is no new physics below 100 GeV or so. This might be very, very dangerous, since that would say that maybe we are hiding physics at very low scales, and we are tuning our Monte Carlo simulations not to the standard model, but to the standard model plus new physics, and this might be very dangerous. I don't have an idea of the impact of this for this specific model, but this is, I believe, an interesting question.
Well, I mean, I think for such low masses and scales, the conclusion should be that that is not the right place to look for them.
Precisely.
What that is doing is more appropriate.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah, this, I'm not saying this is the right place to look at, but maybe they have effects on the Monte Carlos, of course. This guy will always contribute to any, suppose that the dark matter is very heavy for some reason, so the bounds that I was discussing before are not right, and this guy is, I don't know, 50 GeV, the Z prime is 50 GeV, the bounds are very, very weak, and its coupling can be 0.5, what is the effect? We will have like multi-jet effects that we cannot really control because we don't understand QCD.
How will it is constrained by left one? Looking at left one on the Z pole, things like Z to diejet plus missing energy, where
Z plus
missing energy always has a fixed mass, right?
So, okay, that will be. Yeah, I don't know. We didn't look at that. Okay, you're saying like Z is radiating the Z prime or?
Right, well, or say the Z prime is radiated off the quark.
Mm-hmm. Yes, okay, yeah, yeah. I think we looked at that and the bounds were weaker. Of course, you have to pay the price of the mixing, right?
Right.
And
well, sorry, I'm not talking about the mixing, just the U1B to quark coupling.
Okay,
the
okay.
Bodies,
yes.
Bodies,
yeah.
Yeah. No, we didn't look at that. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that has been proposed as an interesting signal. And there were studies for that, also for multi-jet. And the bounds that people estimated were very weak compared to these ones. But we didn't go through the details of those analyses. So the conclusions are the following. I propose a class of models in which the proton can be stabilized, proton stability can be triggered by, in a generic extension of the standard model, it can be technicolor, it can be supersymmetry, and this is true beyond the normalizable level, by embedding the baryon number into gauge symmetry. Here I just focus on the U1B simplest possibility. What happens is that new stable particles generically appear. This will be, of course, my dark matter candidates. And what happens is that the dark matter is generically charged under the baryonic force, so interesting signals. And the dark matter will also have weak scale masses in perturbative models. The interesting feature of these models is that the visible and dark matter will be simultaneously generated in these models by the very same mechanism that explains the baryon asymmetry of the universe. And the visible and dark matter have comparable abundances in these models simply because these two asymmetries are comparable, and the dark matter mass will be set by the weak scale. So it's not far orders of magnitude away from the correct abundance. The current bounds are weak simply because hadronic processes are overwhelmed by QCD, but the more interesting signals are from missing energy colliders. I think that's it. Thank you. Sorry?
The string from Genoa hydro. It is stronger than the string from Clyde.
So for the case of vector coupling, that's already excluded.
Yes.
I mean, Zinor excludes basically these masses. You have to go below the threshold of direct detection experiments to have a model consistent with direct detection experiments. Or you have to have axial couplings to the new gauge force, which is also always possible.
But if you have axial force, you need to have the annihilation just on the pole of the medium.
No.
Because since this is a thick band coupling, the coupling the cross section in the low mass dark matter case, the annihilation cross section is proportional to the square of the mass of dark matter. So if the mass of
what are you assuming? What is the relation between the mass of the dark matter?
There might be a problem for your annihilation for dark matter, for some annihilation of dark matter. You cannot get abundance for low mass dark matter.
Are you sure about that? The only difference we find by computing the annihilation cross section for the case of, so maybe when I say axial, I mean that only the dark matter is charged, has an axial coupling to the Z prime. But of course, quarks, that they have not. They have a vector coupling.
But that doesn't matter because all quarks are light. It doesn't matter if they have vector coupling or axial coupling.
In that case, what you find is that the process is velocity suppressed, but it's not zero. I said that it is velocity suppressed.
Yeah, the velocity is suppressed.
Yes, that's right.
It depends on it is actual vector coupling or vector.
Yeah, precise. Vector axial coupling, it will be.
But I think you're saying you're right, it's suppressed, but it's not zero.
It's suppressed by the dark matter velocity, but the point is that what you have to do is to, what we require is that the annihilation cross-section is big enough.
Yes.
And then we looked at the direct detection signals. Of course, also for the direct detection signals, there will be velocity suppression, but this velocity suppression will be stronger.
There's a time between the collider search and the annihilation between the collider search and the annihilation. So the collider search basically tells you that the coupling should not be larger than some value. And the annihilation tells you the value should not be smaller. There's a tension between them. And I don't think for low mass dark matter, you have enough cross section for annihilation.
This is for axial?
This is
for I agree with what you say, but there is room. So.
Okay, thank you.
I can give you the details later. Now I don't have all the cross sections on top of it.
We have more questions. But if not, then let's connect with the guests.
Thank you.